Welcome, everyone. This is the LaRouche Show for Saturday, July 6, 2013. My name is Marcia Mary Baker. And our topic for today is the Second American Revolution, A New Paradigm for Mankind. Now, this title we chose, we happen to have in mind that this is the week of the 4th of July in the United States and the celebrations for independence. By the way, I want to say in passing, the first one in the country was in North Carolina, in which the German-American Moravians celebrated with music. Mm. And in the tradition of Bach and Handel, mm. they wrote, they set chorales called A Psalm to Joy and Peace. Mm. But for, I say that because it happens also in the last 7 days, it was June 29, that a special conference was held in San Francisco, which was the fifth in a series of international conferences on a new paradigm for mankind. And so the San Francisco event, which was a day-long event last Saturday, was called the Second American Revolution and brought people from especially the western states in the United States. It featured the cultural and musical armament and pleasure we need for a new paradigm for mankind in every way. And it included people from the Pacific, Asia, greetings from around the world, and was addressed by the founder and head of the Schiller Institute, Helga Zepp LaRouche, and also Lyndon LaRouche by video. Now, I say that because we are very glad to have as guests three people associated with this conference, three participants. I have here in the studio with me the delegation from Australia, which consists of Kat Isherwood. Welcome, Kat.
Hi, Marcia.
And Robbie Barwick. Welcome, Robert.
Thanks, Marcia.
And Robbie, some of you have heard before on this program, and we're going to get to that in just a second. But we're going to be joined in about 20 minutes or so from on the ground, literally on the scene in San Francisco, with Michael Steger. Mike was the man on the spot. He was the host, you could say, along with his colleagues elsewhere in San Francisco and Dave Christie, and for this conference, and moderated part of it and spoke. And Mike's going to join us, as I say, in about 20 minutes. He's monitoring right now, and he'll be with us the rest of the hour. But back again to the idea of needing the Second American Revolution. We have a situation that today we're also in the midst, as we were back in the 1700s, with tremendous tumult. So the historical reference is extremely apt on the basis of principle, because we're up against the same enemy. Literally, in the neo-British Empire today, the British Empire at the time, against whom we fought for a revolution, fought a successful revolution, not just for the United States, but for the world, to put down imperial domination and oligarchy. And that's what we're up against now. Now, I want to be brief because we want to hear from our guests. But just as metaphorically, you know, I think it was Ralph Waldo Emerson or someone's poem spoke of the American Revolution starting in New England with a shot heard round the world. And let me say, that is Glass-Steagall reinstatement in the United States. The fact of our mobilization has already been a shot around the world. Mm-hmm. And wait until we get it reinstated. That is going to be a fusillade. That is going to be the great, glorious day. And it's doable. I want to just mention a few things, and then we're going to turn to Robbie Barwick about maybe we're going to begin with the nature of the enemy we're up against. But, you know, now it was just 2 days ago in the state of Oregon that the legislators there introduced a state Senate Resolution 11, I think, for Congress to reinstate Glass-Steagall. So that makes 23 states in this country where it's been introduced. There are still letters, orders going into Congress from around the country. And I bring that up right at the beginning because Congress is resuming. They will be back in Washington, D.C. this coming Monday and Tuesday. They'll be back for the month of July. We're certainly not going to wait till the end of the month. Go like gangbusters, as we've never done before, people listening to this show. And then as far as what we mean by reinstating Glass-Steagall, we could discuss it at length or not. That's not the issue for today. But it's not an on-off switch. Once you get it on, there's a question of what does this mean that we can do? What is this great opportunity? And I just want to point out, most of you regulars listening to this program, and it's around the hinterland of the United States, but abroad, be sure you have seen the July 5 Friday Project LaRouche webcast, because Mr. LaRouche gave very profound and moving answers about what is credit, how does a farmer farm, what is the nature of constantly acting to the betterment of mankind. And he said, it's not a mystery. Start thinking and you know what you can do. So just for sure, everyone make a point of that, either in writing or you can get it on LaRouchePack.com. And we're going to even take certain sections of it and make a special release, have it in other languages for other parts of the world, and I'll tip you off on that. But secondly, we do know that we are in tumult, as I said, when it comes to the threat of all-out war. Our eyes this week have been on Egypt, where an unbelievable mass outpouring of 8 to 10 million people was taking place in Cairo and Alexandria and all around that nation earlier this week. In the last, just today, a few hours ago, Dr. Al-Baradei, who is well known from the IAEA, that's the International Energy Agency, but he is now prime minister. Events are happening by the hour. But again, I refer you to Mr. LaRouche's July 5th webcast. He used the expression, this is a stage. There are forces behind the scenes internationally for good and for ill. And so we're not trying to analyze things from a distance or from within Egypt. It is a change process underway in which it can be seen as an opportunity to push back the forces of evil that want more than constant strife. They want to embroil the world in a war outbreak situation there on the scene that would fast turn into a civilization-killing thermonuclear conflagration. So, without summarizing that, we take note of that. And otherwise, on the events of the hour, just on the what's happened, as you see, with the revelations about the National Security Agency metadata spying, that you get opportunities arising out of the system as long as we move and take advantage of it. In the last 24 hours, I'll give you an example. It's come to pass that people have before them the fact that Britain has said that the European nations who happen to be angry about being spied upon, the European Union office in Washington, D.C. was bugged, other offices have been bugged, and Germany and others have complained. But Britain says, oh no, we can't make anything contingent on being upset and having a commission. Let's form a little task force, because we really have to get on with transatlantic free trade and with bail-in policies. And so it just becomes clear as a nose on your face. And if people aren't caught in their own self-captivity of public opinion, it's ours to mobilize people on to see the reality and to find the courage and identity in themselves to act to change it. So we can, that's where we stand. But I want to turn right away then to our participants at the conference. Robbie Barwick spoke, and I'm so glad you can see his presentation. Everything is posted on the Schiller Institute site. Now, let me tell you, it's newparadigm.schillerinstitute.com. The conference is up there. I'm not sure all the music is people are going to want to hear. But Robbie, among many other things you put before us, it was wonderful to have this kind of special report from down. We may be up under or down under to you, but
up over.
you really also have the credentials as fighting this green fascism, royalist green fascism. Would you start with that?
Sure. Well, in Australia, we've had to identify that the very things that are shutting down our country's ability to exist as a nation, which is the industry and infrastructure that you can't survive without. There's a concerted political effort to shut it down, and it all comes from the Crown. And it all comes from the, and if the Crown is not doing it through free trade policies that is smashing farmers and manufacturers, then they're doing it through this most blatant policy of genocide, which we call green fascism. And we always use the term green fascism whenever we talk about it. We don't just let it settle as green, because it is fascism. At the grassroots where it's implemented, the laws people are forced to abide by in order for this policy to take charge are just extraordinary. And it goes way beyond. I notice in San Francisco everyone has to recycle. It goes way beyond that, especially if you're a farmer. You know, it's actual fascism, and it has the intention of the fascism of the 1930s, which is to destroy people, to wipe out the world's population. But in Australia, the whole process has been directed top down by the Crown in an extraordinary way, hands on, micromanaged by the members of the royal family themselves. Right, so this became quite obvious to us, and what we've been able to do with it is show people that you're not fighting the green policies as a single issue. You're fighting for the survival of your nation, but it's an existential question in that Australians grow up with the Crown. The Queen of England is our head of state.
But right. Then they also say, Robbie, that she's also a figurehead.
Yeah, oh, that's right.
And then you get the thing where you've got this green stuff, and it's a tool. You know, you've got the free trade, you've got the green fascism. They're all mechanisms as an effect to then what? To depopulate. And who's running that agenda?
And they're so blatant in doing it, they've proved they're not a figurehead. Right, you've got to be willfully blind to think the Crown's a figurehead. They're proved not to be so, and we can't go through all the details now. But
we do have a lot of flyers on that we can, that we've been handing around based on what Robbie did at the conference.
Well, there's a lot of resources actually, Marcia, on our website.
Oh yes,
we have a section there called The New Citizen, which is our publication, and there's PDFs of everything we've ever published up there. So it's www.cecaust.com.au, and people can go and see in Technicolor what was done, what is being done in Australia. But what you're looking for, what you want to see the proof of, if you don't believe it, go and see the Crown's role, right? So we came over here to participate in this conference on the Second American Revolution. Because that's exactly what Australia needs. Australia needs to be part of a second American Revolution. Australia has had really good periods in its past, even under the Crown. You know, there's been times when the Crown's control has been not weakened, but it's been blocked from being able to have total say over what happens because of things like World War II, for example, right? So in World War II... there's a huge global war on. In that context, Australia was able to make an alliance with the United States that the British didn't really have a say over, and start a process that transformed our economy and put us on a path of industrialization and massive infrastructure development. So we've got those instances and examples from our past. And I made the point to someone yesterday, all the good things, though, that have happened in Australia have been from America.
Yeah, we have copied America. Go through some of that, any of the instances.
Well, I'll give you the three leading examples. Very early on, it's kind of self-inflicted by the British. They self-inflicted on themselves. When they settled Australia... They settled us to be a strategic outpost, but they populated us with convicts. Well, a significant proportion of those convicts were political prisoners. They were Irish and Scottish and some English political prisoners. In Thomas Paine's Rights of Man, sold a million copies in England in the 1790s, right? So there was a lot of turmoil, ferment there. And so when they sent all these convicts to Australia, and here they send people that want to be independent of Britain, right? So that was there from the beginning. We had an early republican movement. This is the first of the three examples, which was said, we want to become a republic, not a crown colony. And it was led by a really great man that we regard as Australia's equivalent of Ben Franklin. His name was John Dunmore Lang. And he wrote books, and which he said we're fighting for to become the great republic of the South Seas, or the United States of the Southern Hemisphere. These types of names he would give them. He was totally inspired by the United States. The United States was the beacon for the world to model, right? And so we had a republican movement that he founded, and that achieved some things. Out of that came our labor movement, and the labor movement took the spelling, the American spelling of labor, consciously so. LABOR instead of LABOUR, because they wanted to identify with American ideas. And then,
and a lot of our spelling, just for the audience, a lot of the spelling is English-based. Yeah. It's completely different to the United States. So it was, as Robbie's saying, conscious, intentional, deliberate.
Well, of course, we are taught the Queen's English.
Mm.
So this was quite something.
Mm.
And then we had and I was thrilled to be in San Francisco mentioning this in the speech. In 1888, an American named King O'Malley embarked from San Francisco to Australia. And King O'Malley was a Johnny One Note, and that one note was national banking. And he spent his life preaching and educating the Australian people about national banking. And he said in a famous speech in Parliament, he got elected to Parliament, joined the Labor Party, and in 1909 he said, "I am the Alexander Hamilton of Australia. He was the greatest financial genius who ever walked the earth, and his ideas have never been improved upon." And thanks to him, in 1911, we got our national bank called the Commonwealth Bank, which evolved into something that by 1942, in the middle of the war, when Australia joined up forces with the United States, this bank was a government-owned, government-controlled, top-down directed bank that created credit. It didn't borrow it and passed it on. It created credit to invest in the industrialization of the country for the war effort. And it was this extraordinary, the powerful public credit instrument, which the Crown's Privy Council then had to smash.
And that comes back to what you were saying, Marsha, about the American Revolution. When the first American Revolution was created, it was a shot heard around the world.
Yep.
And it was like a packet of dominoes, and it was spreading like wildfire, and they had to try and stop it.
And in Australia, they did it again at the Crown. There's been a number of incidents where the Crown has shown its power, and they've had to show their power when they've tried to stop these American-style mm-hmm. developments in our country.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last great example is development itself, right? And I highlighted at the conference our Snowy Mountains scheme, which was totally inspired by the Tennessee Valley Authority in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
The whole spirit of development, of developing the continent, because we have a big continent, very, very sparsely populated, 23 million people now, three people per square mile, something like that, tiny population density. So the ideas for developing, these were ideas that we borrowed from the example of the United States,
mm.
right? And those are the things that made us a country that we are, in a good sense.
And this is where, going back to what we were saying before that, with the green fascism and all of this, that's why they want to smash it through the green fascism. It's a tool to smash what Robbie just laid out.
Yeah.
It's intentional.
Let me ask you, too, before Mike gets on, if he's ready in a few minutes, is just that you began by saying, well, there's the crown, but literally, Prince Philip, I think you said something like the first Green Party in the entire world was formed.
In Australia,
yeah. Do you want to say?
Yeah, well, it's just this extraordinary story. It's the example of Crown power. And we uncovered the actual true history of it because we've been on this mobilization to stop the Green Movement smashing our premier food bowl called the Murray-Darling Basin.
After the rivers that regularly controlled.
Which is a large river basin, but it's dry, right? So a lot of it is practically desert.
But it relies on, that water is relied upon by all the people that rely on, that are in agriculture.
Yeah, and when did this first really went into full production wide in the 60s?
Well, in the 1890s,
I see.
A couple of guys from Americans from the Imperial Valley, the people who'd helped develop the Imperial Valley here, they came and showed in one place called Mildura that you could turn this desert into a garden.
Okay.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they showed the example, and that was over the century after that, it was more and more developed. But after World War II, it really took off.
Yeah.
And what the Snowy Mountain Scheme did was it put a lot more water into the system. And so you got this basin now grows enough food to feed between 60 and 80 million people. Right, mm-hmm. So the Crown, in its own name, in its own organisation, set out to smash that. So we were doing an investigation as part of our campaign, and we found this historical research that just showed how much it was top-down directed. That Prince Philip personally, he was on a royal tour in 1963, and he took aside the Governor General's private secretary. The Governor General in a country like Australia represents the Queen, right? So. Governor-Generals have a term for about 5 years. The private secretary has a term for about 25 years. They're the real pat. They're the real guy who gets things, the bureaucrat who gets things done. So Prince Philip said to him, I want you to start a branch of my World Wildlife Fund here. And that became this organisation called the Australian Conservation Foundation. When they published flyers, they sent them over to Buckingham Palace for Prince Philip to edit by hand before they distribute them in Australia. This is how much he micromanaged this process.
Terrible, right.
And then in the late 60s, they started a campaign to shut down hydroelectric development in the state of Tasmania. And Tasmania is an extraordinary place because it's a small island, but it's got a lot of everything in it. And the people who lived there were thinking of developing it as a unity. They think about the whole state at once in terms of developing. And so they had there's a mountain range there, and they had a multi-stage hydroelectric scheme worked out. So Prince Philip decided to, we're going to smash that. And he personally directed that campaign to smash this development program. There was a lake that was going to be dammed called Lake Petter. He oversaw the campaign to stop that. He had a screaming match with the state's elected leader, the premier, whose name was Eric Rees. They called him Electric Eric. And it showed, like, Prince Philip personally heavied him. He took him behind closed doors, and he was yelling. The staff reported there was a yelling match. The good news is this Electric Eric yelled back, which was quite something because most people in Australia in those days would not have yelled back at the Crown, right? And in that campaign, they formed the world's first green political party called the United Tasmania Group, and it was out of that that our current Green Party came from, but also Petra Kelly, from who started the Green Party in Germany. She visited Tasmania first in the mid-70s to meet all these guys, and she took that back and started the Green Party in Germany. So it was incubated directly under the Crown's micromanagement. You know, the Crown did this.
Oh, that's really sick. And, I'm being polite. Let me just interpose here, and then I'll ask if Mike wants to get on now or we still have more time. But Robbie and Kat... We were just in 1968 was a book that internationally came right out of the Prince Philip privy unmentionable place. That was the one called Population Bomb.
Oh,
right,
and
yeah.
It was written by this guy who unfortunately is still active, Paul R. Ehrlich. Sure. He's out at Stanford University, and his a co-author at a later book was Obama's current science advisor named John Holdren. Today.
Right.
He was also came up through Stanford and their wives and their this is and their that. But let me just put in one quote apropos of what you said about this evil was incubated in Australia, and here's the outlook of the same network saying, and by the way, what I'm reading from is a January 2013 paper by this man, Paul Ehrlich, Population Bomb, that the Royal Society of Britain published because they elected him its member last year.
Oh, really?
And to mark the occasion, they published 9 pages by him and his wife, who's also at the University of Technology of Sydney, Australia. And here's what he says. He says, the human predicament is driven by overpopulation, overconsumption of natural resources, and the use of unnecessarily environmentally damaging technologies and socioeconomic political arrangements to service Homo sapiens aggregate consumption. And he says this should stop. He said that the population of the world today, if they were to have a living standard of the United States, it would require 5 more Earths.
Yeah,
do the math, we should get rid of 5-6 billion people.
That's right.
Yeah, but imagine if they're having that attitude like that.
Is Obama. Yeah, I agree with you.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
If they're having that kind of attitude, you know, because that is their attitude, there's no question about it. You know, imagine what they think little of human beings. You know, because we were saying the other day, you know, just for example, in Australia, there was a grievance policy from the Australian Conservation Foundation that actually said that human beings are the equivalent to similar idea to a cane toad, where they're a key ecological biodiversity threat or a key threat to the biodiversity of the ecosystem. And that's how they look at human beings, just like what he was saying.
So like an introduced species like a cane toad does a lot of enormous damage to the natural biosphere, so do human beings. That was their point.
So instead of actually coexisting, you know, with the fact that we have a creative power to be able to coexist, solve problems, you know, look at aeroplanes. How come they can go up in the air? It's amazing watching them going up in the air. But we did that by solving problems by coexisting with the universe, you know, and using our creative powers. And if he's saying that, well, he obviously doesn't think we're very creative, and obviously he's not very creative, Marsha.
That's right. He's a little... And he repeats himself after the last 60 years of
population. But we can solve all these problems. And I just wanted to make one point really very quickly, is that this Glass-Steagall, because you were mentioning it before, you know, the Glass-Steagall is actually the flank to, it's a juxtaposition of, you know, the enemy of the British Empire. Because everything that encapsulates that we've gone through, this is the flank so that, you know, it's what is it? It's an ability to have a bum on the seat, if you like, a foundation to then rise up and build the house. You know, it's an intention of development and using your creativity, and that is the tool to be able to do that. And it's what Lynn went through in the credit, you know, what the credit system was last night. You know, money is just the tool.
Right. Well, let me see. Mike, are you there? I can ask you something right now, or we're going to continue.
No, go ahead. I'm on.
Well, let me just put it to you this way, because we're very glad you can take the time. I said that you were, the host, you and your colleagues, of this June 29th event. But I know you, in your introduction of Helga Zepp-LaRouche and all that, you had 12 speakers, I think, you said we're at a deciding moment. So in everything we've talked about, I think that's true. It's not as if it's a continuation. We've looked at the past. Yeah. And now here we are now. Do you want to speak to that at all or reiterate?
Sure. Well, I think that, you know, we were discussing a little bit in the wake of the conference, because one of the major aspects was, you know, what really was the American Revolution? And this has obviously become a growing discussion here in the United States, and as the Australians can testify to, you know, it's happening more and more globally. What does it mean to break from this kind of empire policy? You know, obviously the Bill of Rights has played a certain role, but what is the essence of it? And what you see in looking at the United States is a unique characteristic where our greatest poets were our greatest political leaders, and our greatest economists were our greatest scientists, whether it be Benjamin Franklin, Alexander Hamilton, Henry Carey, or, you know, Lyndon LaRouche now. But there's a unique quality of how you integrate the questions of art, science, and politics as a single conception of what the human mind is. And that really defines the current crisis today. Because unless that becomes a conscious understanding, we are going to see an absolute and total collapse of the human species. That's what's intended. Steps have been taken since John Kennedy's assassination now 50 years ago this November to shut down any legacy of that kind of conception, whether it be from Einstein and Planck, whether it be from Franklin Roosevelt and his followers in the United States political tradition. So 40, 50 years now of shutting down the ability for the human species to survive. We are helpless and defenseless against asteroids. We have shut down our space program even further under Obama. And we've allowed a certain financial tyranny on an international scale, not just to parasite, but to set the conditions for a mass depopulation genocide policy. They call it the Greens, they call it monetarism, they call it the stock market, they call it, as one farmer that spoke at the conference, they call it the invisible hand. It's not our fault, it's just this invisible hand. Hmm. The fact is they've set up conditions for massive genocide. Now, how do you stop that? The inertia for that kind of population reduction has been in place under a policy since the assassination of John Kennedy, his brother, the takedown of the gold standard under Nixon, and the ongoing set of policies undermining farming, the infrastructure, the water supply. We see it today in California, shutting down the nuclear power plants that were built 30 and 40 years ago. We are not prepared to survive. Mm. So we're going to have a major shift in policy.
Mm-hmm.
But the question of existence today, because this whole system's gone, this system is bankrupt, it's financially gone. You see it. You see the desperation by, you know, the new head of the Bank of England, Mark Carney, and Draghi. No. What Bernanke said isn't true. We're going to keep printing. Yeah, but all of the banks in Europe are dependent upon the Federal Reserve.
Yep.
It's just an imposition, a fascist imposition upon the policy here to break the United States. So if we're going to win, we're going to have to reassert that the real commitment has to be a sense of statecraft, of scientific advancement. I think as Lynn described it last night, a sense of energy flux density. We've got to advance our power supply. This idea of wind energy, these things are subsidized massive amounts. They're three times more expensive than any power supply available otherwise. There's no way these are an economically viable alternative to the survival of the human species. We've got to have a commitment to the real essence of the American Revolution. And that's happening now. You see it in Egypt, what's happened there, the collapse of the Portuguese government, what's happening in Greece now. It's all over the world that there is a complete breakdown of governments. So there's two alternatives. Either we go with a population reduction policy in place, or you shut down that entire system and you go back to a real American Revolution. Mm-hmm. And I think, as you indicated, Marcia, earlier, the initial battle on that question, the deciding moment, the deciding point, is this question of Glass-Steagall. It's not just a funny name. It's an actual fundamental shift in the way the system is operating. So,
do you want to respond to that in terms of worldwide, but Australia?
No, but that's why Helga LaRouche has launched this series of conferences on the new paradigm, because that's what Mike's laid out there. That's the basis of the new. What's the new paradigm that can actually solve this? Humanity is on its knees under the imperial policies of the British Empire, right? And the people recognize, people feel the economic crisis, and what they've got to understand that is. The source of that economic crisis is the British Empire. Wall Street is actually the City of London. You know, we got a quote from in our publications where the Chatham House, which is the Royal Institute for International Affairs, you know, they call themselves, that in their own words today, they describe the empire as an informal financial empire, right? So this network of globalized banks and with interlocking directorships all around the world that are... They've gone from bailing themselves out through getting the central banks to bail them out mm-hmm. to now bail in where they're trying to steal deposits to prop themselves up. This is the empire determined to survive, keep its imperial power, but people get in the way. And just as an aside, you know, Thomas Malthus wrote his essay on population on the payroll of the East India Company, that was 1799. There was about 1 billion people in the world then. You know, and 1799,
yeah.
His essay on population.
Right.
And these clowns today who work for the Crown, like Schellenhuber, what they're saying is we're going to take it back to that billion people that existed at that level of 1 billion people in Malthus's time. And it is absolutely intentional. So we know that, but Helga's addressing this question of, you know, what's the change going to be? And there has to be a new paradigm. And in all those areas that Mike was talking about, to underpin the daily lives of the people. But our perspective as Australians is that the seeds of that new paradigm already exist in our history,
mm-hmm.
right? And in our history as Australia, that comes from our pro-American tradition. And in your history, that is your history, that is the American history, that is Lincoln, etc.
And that goes back to what Marsha was saying, you know, when the American Revolution was founded or when America
conducted,
the shot was heard from around the world.
And we heard
it's infectious because what are you appealing to when you say American Revolution? You're appealing to the fact that, you know, we're a sovereign nation state. Why do you want to be a sovereign nation state? Well, you actually want to develop and grow your population to strive to be the best that they can possibly be.
One of the things I think
the oligarchy, that's a human being.
One of the things I think the oligarchy fear is that if there is a paradigm shift
mm-hmm.
along the lines we're talking about, where the world takes up as its cause the common aims of mankind, the way Helga describes it, progress can be very fast.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't take very much. You know, when you see in the context of 3 years in World War II how quickly Australia's economy industrialised, it's stunning. If the intention's there, progress can be very, very fast. So you got the oligarchy now got its foot on the neck of humanity with these economic fascism. You know, bail in, bail out.
Yeah, because what are they suppressing? They're suppressing the creativity to take off and go boom through the roof.
Yeah. So as Australians,
and that's the green fascism, which is a tool of the British Empire that wants to smash that, because it's everything that a human being actually is that they're trying to smash through being greedy, through doing all these things.
So our confidence in the future comes from our appreciation of the American system.
Mm-hmm.
Right. One thing, Mike, you're still there?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, good. It was good. Let me just, speaking of looking at the American system, but I don't understand me if I use the right word, the California system. I mean, at the best time, coherent, one and the same with the American system. The development there at certain times was very fast.
Mm.
In the legacy of Franklin Delano Roosevelt, we think of FDR, we think of the Hoover Dam, the big Columbia River dams, but the state of California, when it went out to build aqueducts, levees, channels, mm-hmm. reservoirs, right, Mike? That came up during your conference as a touch point for what Robbie just said. If you move, you can start to create an environment that was never before imagined. Do you want to say anything about that, Mike, or...?
Oh, absolutely. I think that's, we in discussions about what is this Glass-Steagall shift entail, people will be shocked what you tell them it was like 25 years from now.
Yeah.
Obviously there's the more obvious ones of the fact that you've got, young people going into schools and shooting each other and these kinds of things. And the things that Helga raised, just the kind of culture you have amongst 12, 13, 14-year-olds,
mm-hmm.
in 25 years, we can eradicate that kind of mental insanity that we've now created within the younger generation. And people will be stunned how severe it's gotten, because it already is a dark age within that culture, if not generally. But the bigger questions we have, there is such potential. And I think what's fascinating, you take two things, what Lynn said, and then also what the farmer Frank Endres presented at the conference, that the greatest investment one can make is in water infrastructure. Because with a water infrastructure, they can testify to this in Australia, mm-hmm. we know it would be true in Africa, we know it would be true. Because it's not just a question, one, you have deserts. You usually have two questions. You either have, a flood or a desert. You got two choices, right? And that's what you've got to figure out. How do you manage your water supply? Mm-hmm. How do you manage your land area? Because once you take on that step, you create the basis for the developments of the city, the developed advanced city systems and city infrastructures. You set up the basis for advanced industry, for the chemical processes you need, for the broad energy policies you need. I mean, nuclear power still needs, a large amount of water supply.
Mm-hmm.
These things are required for heavy industry. And so once we take on something like NWAPA, we will drastically transform within a generation. It will be the most drastic transformation mankind has ever seen. Because once you take on projects like NWAPA here, you take them on in Australia, in the desert there, in Central Asia, in North Africa, in the general management of our planet's resources and land area, we will set a platform of which no one's really, people won't have ever conceived the condition mankind will participate in.
Yep.
Once we set that kind of foundation, and it can happen within 25 years, and the immediate changes can happen within 5 or 10.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, you know, that's where some of the pessimism and cynicism, people have somewhat given up on the fight. And the people have to look at themselves. This is a little bit what you confront when you're out organizing
mm-hmm.
the population. People have given up on that potential. They've seen it in their lifetimes. Many of these 60 and 70-year-old participants in society today, the engineers that helped build some of the dams and the infrastructure, they've given up on that potential. But they've seen it. They've seen how rapidly it can happen. They know the effect it can have. We have to kind of, people have to look at themselves and realize that this is a time in history where their commitment to their pessimism will be the reason why we don't win.
Yeah. Americans have got to realize that with NAWAPA, you're not just improving the United States, you're raising the platform for the whole world. Because, you know, America's the most powerful economy in the history of the world. Right, and not only would a project like NAWAPA restore that, it would extend it in a way that lifts the living standards of the planet. It's not just a United States project. Our projects in Australia, we don't have one quite on NAWAPA's scale, but that's the way we think about it. We, you know, if we can build things like our Bradfield scheme, we can grow food that will feed hundreds of millions of people, far more than our population is capable of growing to for a long mm-hmm. time, right?
I was just going to add on to what Mike was saying, because, you know, you've got the pessimism in the population, but with these optimistic ideas, that's what we've got to appeal to from the standpoint of that, you know, because deep down, I mean, you know, everyday life and all of this sort of thing, you know, I've lost my job, I've got the kids, it's too much money, all of this stuff, you know. But we've got to appeal to them, you know, to their, you know, because what makes them them, you know, at the end of the day, they're human beings,
yeah.
you know. And
they want to survive.
And there's, you know, we've been downtrodden and downtrodden and downtrodden, and we have to appeal to the, you know, from the standpoint of what we're doing right now, which is the Glass-Steagall, which, you know, the United States is, you know, being very, very successful, if you like, you know, from the standpoint of planting those seeds and getting that movement in motion. And, you know, we have to appeal to the population from an optimistic standpoint that this, if you don't want to die, well, you have to join us. Because your life actually does depend on it. So if you don't want to die, join us now.
And I think people would like to hear if either one of you would take 5 minutes on, or a few minutes on, the Citizens Electoral Council. That's what CEC stands for. It was formed, I think, 25 years ago. You just had a special kind of
25th anniversary
conference.
Mm-hmm.
And with people running for office in particular, I know you have the federal election. Well, I don't know if that's changed. The government should. Go ahead.
The government changed. I think the federal election is still scheduled for September 14th. But
well, when we were on a plane, we got a new prime minister.
Yeah.
And we thought it was quite ironic that we were getting a new prime minister when we were coming into the United States, and that would never happen.
We put it as a headline in our weekly publication in Australia this week. The headline. Our old prime minister's name was Gillard, and we put the headline, Gillard to Morsi to Obama.
Okay.
So, you guys, watch this space. You might have good news soon.
Yes.
Now, the CEC is quite unique because our founder, Craig Isherwood, who's Kat's father-in-law, and people around him 25 years ago, they were in rural industry, and they were experiencing the first wave of the destruction of industry caused by globalization, you know, free trade policies, etc.
Australia was used as the model, the battering ram for the whole world, the example of the
exactly.
World Trade Organization poster country.
In agriculture, we are it. We are the country that is held up as an example for free trade. This is Australians all accepted free trade, and look what it's done for them. Yeah, nothing. It's killed us. Anyway, Craig was determined to fight that. And the only way to fight it was not as one of the existing institutions, but to start a new one. And providentially, and it is providential, they met very early on. They were introduced to a representative of EIR who happened to be in New Zealand at the time, named Alan Douglas, who was from the States here. And through Alan Douglas, they were introduced to LaRouche, right? And so of all the political parties in Australia, we are the ones with a sense of what you know, Schiller said patriots but world citizens, right? Because we instantly recognized that the crisis that we were confronted with was a global one, and the predicates were remarkably similar in every country you went. And so with that in mind, we've been a federally registered political party. The way we've survived is by, once we identified that the source of the problem was the Crown, the way we've survived was attacking it relentlessly. And so for the better part of, I think our first big anti-Crown publication was 20 years ago. So for 20 years, we have hit the Queen and Prince Philip hard at every turn.
Because also the problem is, if you want to get anything done, you know, in anything, you have to go for the source of the problem or the cause of the problem. And if you're going to be sitting in the same, you know, system, and you're going to try and solve the problem within the system, you're kidding yourself. You know, and I think that's what Craig and all of you guys figured out pretty quickly, especially when we're getting attacked by the Queen.
Yeah, well, that's right. Interests. Where's this coming from, right? And so we've done that. The only way the establishment can deal with us, you guys have an Australian changed his citizen to become an American for business reasons named Rupert Murdoch. So he lives here now, but he still controls pretty much all the Australian media. After some pretty vicious attempts to slander us to death, which didn't work, the only way the Murdoch media can deal with us now is through virtually total media blackout, right? Hardly any mention of us at all. Which is very tough as a political party to sort of function under that suppression. But despite that, we have grown and prospered, and now Kat and I flew out of the middle of a very intense campaign where we can actually stop the equivalent of your Dodd-Frank bill, right? Because we got wind of it, and we're the one political institution in the country that's capable of stopping it, and we've just caused the biggest stink you can imagine to stop this bail-in law going through. And if it does, if we do stop it, because we're fully capable of stopping it, and that which no other party could do, but if we do stop it, it would be a real problem for the Bank for International Settlements, the Bank of England, and those directing this worldwide, because this bail-in policy of stealing bank accounts to prop up the banking system will only work if it is global, if it is implemented everywhere. Because the Lehman Brothers showed us, Marsha, that with the nature of the derivatives bubble, there's $1.4 quadrillion in derivatives. You blow a big enough hole in it in one bank, and we've got four big banks that could blow a big hole in it. If you blow a big enough hole in it in one bank, you can melt down the whole global system, right? And that's why they're determined to make it global. And we might be able to buck that, and we're the ones positioned to do it because of our 25-year history with LaRouche.
And hence the fight for Glass-Steagall.
Oh, yeah. Well, one national publication in Australia reported that bail-in was being discussed for Australia, that very day in the federal parliament, the CEC's a petition that we'd been circulating calling for Glass-Steagall banking separation to be enacted in Australia was tabled in the federal parliament, read into the official record. People could hear the proceedings all around the country on their radios or TV stations, wherever they're watching, and all the parliamentarians had to sit there and listen to this petition being read in calling for a Glass-Steagall banking separation for Australia.
Good. That's good news. We like satisfaction too, don't we? We want to get some jailing, and we want to have jail time for these.
Oh yeah. I have a personal list.
Okay,
I have a personal list. Oh no, we have the. I mean, they're crooks. You know, you guys have one of our. One of my pet hates is pretty big here as well. Macquarie Bank.
Oh yeah, you can go ahead on that one.
Yeah, well, you know, these are private toll road operators, but they're much bigger than that. The Macquarie Bank is a subsidiary of a City of London bank called Hill Samuel, and this is Hill Samuel comes out of the nexus with Royal Dutch Shell and Lazard and those type of synecdoche institutions, you know, going way back. But Macquarie Bank designed the deregulation of the Australian financial system in the 1980s. And there's a whole series of people who are involved in that who should all be forced to testify before a Pecora-style commission and confess their crimes, and half of them will go to jail. But I was I found it very fascinating recently reading a book on one aspect of this, where they get their money from pension funds. So poor workers are forced to hand over a percentage of their pay to put in a pension fund for the future they can't touch until they retire, right? And that goes to this outfit, Macquarie Bank and a few others, to invest around the world in public-private partnerships and toll roads and the
Sydney
like.
Sydney Harbour Bridge, which Robbie actually referenced Bradfield, but the Bradfield scheme, which was the water project, he also engineered the Sydney Harbour Bridge, and this is our icon in Sydney. You have to pay a toll to get over it. I'm pretty sure that's by Macquarie Bank.
Yeah, Macquarie Bank owns all these toll roads in Sydney. Anyway, this guy wrote a book praising him to the hilt. He had a really funny way of... He said, Australia, thanks to Macquarie Bank's model, Australia can become the Antipodean, which means southern, the Antipodean Venice. they want to turn us into the old Venetian monetary empire or a branch of the Venetian
tyranny
monetary empire.
Tyranny of the Mediterranean. You're supposed to be part of the world tyranny.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. So we use our money funds to go and conquer the world on behalf of the City of London. You
know? Well, it makes sense that would be the case based on the intention of what we're doing at the moment.
The problem is if green fascism doesn't enrage the Australian population, which it does, they're enraged by it. Their other pet hate is privatisation.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a revolt brewing that we're leading.
Well, if Mike is still there, and maybe he wants to say, we can give the last word to our Australian guests, but Mike, it's not time to close out. If you want to, however, since I know you're busy there on the ground in San Francisco, if you want to say anything post-conference or about the coming days that are critical in making the shift in the United States, go right ahead.
Well, I think that people should just wipe their assumptions off the table of what they think has been possible up to this point. We're at a historical moment. A conference should be available on the website. People can get a sense of the new paradigm as a living conception. It's available to the imagination. The policies are laid out. Marcia's presentation was excellent on the question of the real potential agriculture. We've got the authority on how to solve this problem. But people have to get away from what Mr. Lewis has, consistently, exposed, that people get caught up thinking that what's possible is only based on what they've experienced so far. And that what's possible right now under this kind of historical circumstance, the kind of optimism, the kind of fight that we've mobilized, that this organization has mobilized internationally now for 40 years, makes it possible that we win this fight, and we win it not just for the next generation or two, but we win it for the next millennium. We set a course of human development that can go on for centuries. But people have to have a sense that that's possible. If we have that, I think we will reawaken and win this second American revolution.
Thanks, Mike, very much. And I can go back... you can always interrupt if you want to say more, but I really appreciate you being on. But one thing in what you're saying about don't go by what you think you've known, you have to wipe your assumptions aside. Mm. One aspect of this conference that bears on our Australian guests here is that the whole Pacific universe was, the larger Pacific basin was very much represented there, and a gentleman who's Chinese-American or Chinese-based in America spoke and took his way back to Confucius and Mencius and the idea of prospering the other, or the golden rule in Chinese historical terminology. So again, in the remaining minutes, anything you've had, you're bringing a great sense of fight. We love a good fight. It's part of the American Revolution, I guess. Or those convicts that they shipped off and then had their... But do you want to say more, either historically or looking ahead, about what you're doing in Australia? You mentioned Mr. Bradfield, who was a great TVA man kind of guy for the whole continent. You could fill that in a few minutes. You have a lot of on the agenda of what you want to see happen in Australia.
Do you want to say something?
No, you can say something.
Oh, well... there's many things to say. One thing I do want to say is that I wish Americans looked at LaRouche and this movement the way we do, right? Because you got to appreciate what you've got, and it's a huge difference to the Australian nation and the future of Australian nation. Us meeting LaRouche and Helga and these ideas, and having that global sense of the truth of what we're fighting for. And then that gives us the confidence that in our ideas for the future, because we've got plenty of them. We could, if we could overthrow the Crown's control in Australia, you could quickly get rid of the situation where 1 billion people in the world go hungry, because we alone could produce so much extra food.
Absolutely.
It's not possible, right? And if we got rid of the Crown's control in Australia, we could do a lot towards taking away the danger of war, because the big one is the targeting of China with this Asia pivot that Obama announced, where in doing so he's just being a total agent for the British.
Mm-hmm.
But so are we. And Australia is part of that, and China looks at Australia and America and Japan and a few others as being forming an Asian NATO to target them. And unfortunately, they're right, you know, because there's an imperial mentality driving this from the Brits, which is, if we can't control the world, we'll blow it up,
mm-hmm.
right? And no human being wants that, but they've got to be prepared to look at the oligarchical mindset, which we are. So we know if we can win this fight on those and get rid of the Crown like that, then the world can be a much better place much more quickly. And yeah, there is no limit. You can't project onto the future what you know from the past.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Right. And Benjamin Franklin, you know, this idea, you know, he said, "I've given you a republic, you know, but that is if you can keep it." You know, this is really the time now to prove that we can keep it. You know, and it's not just, you know, for you guys, but just for the rest of the world. You know, and that's the fight that we've got to have, you know. And it's like, well, Helga says, you know, one fist across five continents. You know, it really is a global fight. But it has to start, you know, with what the United States is doing here. You know, and, you know, that's that.
Yeah, you look at the, you were just thinking about, in terms of the food basket for the entire world, in terms of a nation that could be committed and bring about peace, and also your resources, the thorium, that we have to literally power up
the world
our
is
planet.
Our oyster. Mm-hmm.
And because what you raised before, these characters that say, or Mike might have raised it, about wind power, not nobody believes that that's the issue there.
No.
Isn't as if it's, oh, some people made a mistake and they thought it was more efficient. No, they're doing
no.
it to kill. They
it's
might the just as well say Australia, like Jonathan Swift, who was on the side of humanity, the dean of was it Trinity University in Dublin, who was Dean Swift, who wrote Gulliver's Travels. I mean, Warren Buffett tomorrow, if he says, what I'm really putting my billions into is getting moonbeams out of cucumbers, that's same.
That stock will go up on Wall Street.
But, I mean, again, Australia, the excitement of the imagination of what ought to be done.
I mean, we've got so much thorium. LaRouche says, made a point once, you guys have it mostly desert. That's an opportunity, right?
Mm-hmm.
Water it, develop it. We've got so much thorium, we could have a network of nuclear-powered desalination plants right around the coast, you know, desalinating. We're not going to run out of it. 70% of the Earth is water, right? The Earth will never run out of water, but you got to know how to grab it, and this is what you could do. Plus, in a country like Australia, if we did that, we could do it on a scale that has never been done on nuclear before, and you can make breakthroughs in economies of scale, which is allowed. You know, there's always these debates about the cost of nuclear. Well, yeah, if you pursued it on the scale that it demands, right, you can make, in a country like Australia, on a scale that a country like Australia could, if it was our intention, we could improve its the way it works for the whole planet.
And the cost, if you don't do it, is actually greater. The money's just a tool.
Yeah, of course.
It's just a shadow.
Right. Well, I think we've come to the end of the time, and I want to, if you want to say anything special about, our guests are based in Melbourne. They're leaving within 24 or 48 hours.
Yeah.
And we're glad they swung around and could be here after the California events and meeting everyone. If you want to say any final comment, otherwise we thank you very much.
No, it's been good. And the conference, I do recommend everyone watch it, including the musical, especially
beautiful.
The music. It was really, really wonderful to be there for it.
Okay, great. And people should know, look on newparadigm.schillerinstitute.com. And otherwise, if you search, if you don't remember all of this, put in Citizens Electoral Council and Australia, and you get their website. And then, for sure, look at this. I think you may have it out as a book on the Crown's Green Fascism in the coming months or weeks.
Well, not weeks, and hopefully months.
Okay.
But we do have a newspaper, which you can look up, as Robbie was saying, on the website, cecost.com.au.
Okay. Well, with that, thank very much, Mike Steger, if he's still there in San Francisco.
Thanks,
Kat,
Mike.
Thanks, Mike.
Robbie Barwick.
Thanks, Marsha.
And this ends the July 6th, 2013 LaRue Show. Thank you.
Thanks, Marsha.